In August 2012, Dean Crosby from Active Edge and Steve Nash crossed the Pyrenees as part of an unsupported Volbivouac trip, flying and hiking over 430 kilometres from the Atlantic coast in France to the Mediterranean in Spain. They have recorded another podcast with details of the trip, and if you have not already done so, you can download this from the podcast page at www.judithmull.net/blog. Dean and Steve have a vast amount of experience of fly hiking, and in this follow-up podcast, they share the insights they gleaned from the trip, what kit worked and what didn't, route planning, foot care, and lots of other useful advice. Tell me about your preparations then. How did you actually prepare for the trip?
Well, regarding the backpacking kit, I have most of that that's been, you know, tried and tested over sort of many times, many weeks. And I think, yeah, it's really important to be familiar with your kit, you know, to know how to use it in the mountains, obviously. I was quite au fait with all the kit, all the backpacking side of it. And then I've spent many hours researching clothing that we were going to wear, because we wanted clothing that would be suitable for flying and also suitable for walking as well. So, for example, you know, like a Gore-Tex jacket, I looked at a particular type of Gore-Tex jacket, active shell, which is lightweight, small, packable, you know, small pack size. I wanted a jacket with pit zip so I can, you know, so you can, if it's hot, can vent it a little bit. Because we knew we'd be dealing with temperatures probably from just a couple of degrees above freezing to, you know, 35, 40 degrees. So we had to choose the kit really carefully because we knew that obviously we had to carry everything.
I think from my experience, I had pretty well all the necessary lightweight kit for this trip based on, you know, previous experience and in particular X-Alps. The one thing that stuck out from Dean's experience was his use of the tarp shelter. The tarp was a revelation, really. It's so super light and really versatile.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very simple design. It's just a pentagon. I think each side is about, I think it's 7 foot on each side. So you just got five sides, and you can rig it in so many different shapes. You know, you can rig it as like a square or a pentagon. You can rig it at different heights. So therefore, when it's windy, you can have it low to the ground. So it's almost like stealth-like. You know, the wind just blows around it. So you never get any of the material rattling around like you do in the tent, even in a strong wind. So it's such a versatile thing. And then plus, coupled with a bivy bag, you know, you've got a system that's light, that's very sort of quick to dry, and that also sometimes in refuges, bothies, you're just using the bivy bag and you don't need the shelter. And on occasions, we never put the shelter up because, well, one, we couldn't when we slept in some odd places like playgrounds and church gardens. We couldn't put a tarp up then, but we knew the weather was good, so we were fine sleeping outside. So the bivy bag then was perfect for that. So yeah, I knew that the tarp would be just perfect for this sort of trip. You know, you can camp high with it, it'll put up with all sorts of weather, there's plenty of room in there as well, and it's quick to dry, quick to put up. Of course, you don't have to take any poles with you, because what you're using your trekking poles as the support. So you've got one pole in the middle, and then you've got a pole on one of the edges to make like a door. So yeah, it was really versatile.
And how much does it weigh?
The one that we, with all the pegs, we took two different types of pegs. So we took some really sort of substantial 9-inch pegs that you would use in softer ground. But I knew that a lot of the time we would be camping on very sort of hard surfaces. So we took some little titanium like skewers. And with that, it weighed just, I think 700 grams it weighed. And that was, wow. You know, that was for two people. But actually prior to that, I bought exactly the same tarp that's made out of this Cuban fiber, which is literally the half of the weight of silk nylon, which we took. But having used it a couple of times in the UK before we went, I just decided that it just wasn't up to the job because you didn't have a stretch in the material and it was really difficult to rig. So we decided not to take that and we took the Sil 9 on one, which was, yeah, I mean, it just performed perfectly, really.
So did you do quite a lot of sort of practicing together, trying out all the kit and stuff in Britain before you went?
No. We did most of the preparation for the trip on Skype, to be honest.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was really started off by sharing ideas, starting to look at maps, looking at routes, and then as time got, you know, nearer to us leaving, then there was more of a focus on the kit that we were taking. And the way we did that was basically both created a kit list that we thought was what we needed to take, and then just had like tennis sessions on the Skype of, you know, no, we don't need this, I think we should take that, and basically honing it down to what we believed was the absolute minimum we could possibly take and still be, you know, safe and perform well. So we only got together really the once to fly, and that was just as Dean had received the first glider. So really we didn't. I mean, I think fitness wise, you know, we've both a good level of fitness, so we didn't really need, you know, check and validate each other on the fitness. I think we were both confident that we could manage this from a, like, an endurance point of view. So it was really more the kind of the technical decisions on kit and maps and routes and weather, I suppose.
Yeah, it was a little bit different on my side regarding the fitness, because, yeah, obviously Steve's fitness is well known, like, throughout the paragliding community. And I had quite a few people saying to me, how are you going to keep up with him? How are you going to keep up with him, you know? He's done the X Lakes, X Scotia and X Alps and, yeah, anything but an X at the front. And so I kept getting that question asked to me. And I don't know how I answered it, really, but I just thought, well, I'm going to have to get out there and do as much training as I can. So you know, not to let Steve down. Yeah, I think we were pretty well matched in the end, to be honest. I did quite a bit of training, and we kept together, and it was fine, wasn't it?
It was, and I mean, I was really pleased that we just moved all the time, you know, never, because I think one of the things that I can remember discussing with Dean was about the you know, constant moving. Because throughout a day, keep stopping, you know, to change your jacket, to top up with water, all these little 5-10 minutes all add up to quite a significant amount of time at the end. And I remember you asking that question. I thought we moved really well together, really did.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because I noticed, you know, I've been walking with lots of people, and I noticed most of the people, they'll stop. So they, you know, they'll think, okay, right, I'm hot now, so I need to take something off, and then they take something off, and then 5 minutes later they're cold again, they're putting something on. And it's all about preparing yourself, so you don't have to stop. You perhaps just stop for your lunch, and as Steve says, if you can keep moving, then all the time we were moving east rather than stopping every 5 minutes for something. So
the only thing is, though, I wouldn't like to give the impression that we were perfect, because
no.
How many times did we have to stop each other to say, have you turned your spot on?
And then I mean, you said that you actually had most of the kit already, but that you had to buy the tarp. So did you, I mean, is it a kind of major expense buying all this kit to actually do this?
Yeah, I had to buy quite a bit of it. Well, I didn't have to, but I just thought I wanted to give myself the best chance. And with that, I wanted the best kit. So I did quite a bit of research, and for the kit that I already had and that I was happy with, then I kept. But as I say, things like, you know, the Gore-Tex Active Shell jacket and trousers. I wanted trousers, Gore-Tex trousers with a fly, so I could, like, relieve myself in case we did a really long flight, but that wasn't necessary. So that took quite a bit of research on the internet, just finding the right sort of kit.
But just for kind of anybody who's thinking of possibly doing the same, can you give me like a rough figure of roughly how much of an investment it would be if somebody didn't have any lightweight kit but would want to kind of go shopping for a trip like this?
I guess the major thing to think of if you were, you know, starting from scratch is that the lightweight market is very much based on the laws of diminishing returns, i.e., you know, you pay an awful lot at the top end to pair off the tiniest amount of weight. It's quite difficult to put a price on it, I'd suggest, because a lot of the stuff that we've got there in that list, you could get an almost, you know, functional-wise, it would be almost as good, but just not quite as light, but have a massive effect on the price, the total price.
You could buy most of it at Decathlon, couldn't you? Probably at
absolutely
like half the price or even less. It would be nearly as good, but like you say, not quite as good.
Okay, so you guys went like ultra lightweight, you know, as light as you possibly could. Was there any bits of your kit where you actually felt that you could have, you know, maybe should have gone slightly differently? I mean, we'll talk later about kind of what you would do differently, but is there anything about your kit that you would have done differently?
When I'm doing like an ultralight backpacking trip, is I'm looking for, you know, to take kit that perhaps does, you know, two or maybe even three jobs. For example, like the trekking poles, you know, I need them, but I also need them for the tarp as well. And also things like just a book, you know, you can use as like a hat, a pillowcase, a towel, you know. So there's all these, what you're trying to do is look at the kit and look how many jobs it can do. You know, you don't need to take like a separate towel or maybe a separate hat.
Just while we're on kit, can you just mention your super duper walking poles?
Yeah, that's quite interesting for me because I've never really been a convert to poles at all. But in training for the X-Alps, people were absolutely adamant, you know, you need to use poles. You need to get used to walking a lot with poles. So that's exactly what I did. And I went with a black diamond carbon pole, I think it's the Z pole, which is one of the lightest that you can get your hands on. And in preparation for the trip, they were the ones I was going to take. But Dean had shown me these pacer poles, which were the carbon version. And initially I wasn't convinced because the only thing that was important to me was lightweight. And these are lightweight by comparison to normal poles, but not compared to, say, the Black Diamond Z. So I was a little bit resistant, and Dean said, well, I can hopefully try and get you a pair, and then you can try them. So I tried them locally here, and I wasn't convinced, but I read the background information from the manufacturer's pacer, and it all seemed to make sense in that these poles actually make you walk differently, so that they're extensions of your arms rather than normal poles. You kind of rotate your wrists with the pole on the end, but these are an extension of your arm, and what that does is it pushes your shoulders back and opens up your chest and basically makes you more efficient. Now, when we started this trip, they were just poles. By the end of the trip, I was absolutely convinced that they were really making a difference. And for this kind of trip, I would have no hesitation but to seriously choose these. And I've recommended them to friends now based on my experience. And you've got to remember that a lot of this trip was just walking for maybe 10 hours a day. And you suddenly realize whether a pole's working or not when you clocking up those kind of kilometres.
Well, I was certainly very interested in the ergonomic design of the handles because obviously I've got really bad knees, and I find that with normal walking poles, where, like you say, you rotate the wrist, if I'm walking for 5 or 6 hours, my wrists are killing me. So the thought of having to do that for like 18 days for like 7 hours a day, there's just, you know, it doesn't even bear thinking about. So, you know, when I had a look at yours, I was like, ooh, that looks quite good, really.
Yeah. But there's other advantages with the climbing and descending. I can only describe climbing with these poles as like having two ropes either side of you, and you are using the poles to almost pull you up the hill. That's exactly what it feels like. And then going downhill, you've got almost like a platform underneath your wrist that really seems to work, because I just didn't think that would work as well as it did. But yeah, I have to say that I'm pretty converted to them now.
Yeah, one other thing about them as well is that because there aren't any straps, then, you know, if you come to a stile or a gate, then it's just straight under your arm. There's no taking them out of a strap and putting them back into, you know, once you've gone through the gate, putting your hand through a strap again. There's none of that, you know, so it's quick turnaround as well. Or if you want to read a map or whatever, yeah.
But again, that's interesting from my experience, because when we started the trip, I had these tiny, they're very lightweight, little straps on these. They're not like the big straps on a normal pole. But Dean said to me, he says, you won't need those. And I was like, no, I'll stick with them, don't worry. It was only maybe a day or so before I cut them off.
Steve, you've done all these different X competitions.
Yep.
How did doing those help you in the preparation for this?
I guess having those behind me, those X events, it gave me a lot of the fundamental requirements for this type of trip, you know, from a kit point of view. The primary things are that everything has to be light, functional, but predominantly reliable. You know, it's really no good having a wing that's constructed from some super light material that just can't stand up to a rock-strewn launch. You know, it's so important that it's a durable piece of kit as well. This must be the biggest single thing that I learned from X-Alps is around foot care, in that you really have to treat your feet as the most important part of, you know, whatever you're doing on these long trips. It's absolutely paramount. If you lose your feet, as in, you know, damage, then it doesn't matter what light pack or wing you're going to fly or whatever, it's going to hold you back. So both of us put an awful lot of attention, that's before, during, and in Dean's case, after the trip, to kind of foot issues. It's so important, it really is. You know, that's really my single biggest piece of advice to people doing anything this big, is look after your feet first.
But, I mean, that's easier said than done when you're unsupported, because, I mean, when I did the podcast with Tom about the preparation for the X-Alps, and indeed, you know, how the X-Alps went for him, he was mentioning that Thomas Coquenilla was the sort of trailblazer for, you know, like changing your socks every few hours and wearing different trainers every day and stuff. But you only had two pairs of socks with you, and you only had one pair of shoes. So how do you look after your feet in those circumstances?
I'd been used to looking after my feet, but not quite to the extent that we did on this trip. And so I learned quite a lot. We had two socks, so we had like a liner sock, which is made by a company called Injinji. And they have these rather novel, that they're actually toe socks. So they've got like almost like fingered gloves. They've got little fingers or little toes on the sock. So they were great. They kept your feet a little bit cooler, just like a glove does, as opposed to a mitt. And they also kept any sort of rubbing in between your toes. So we had them, and then I actually had some compression socks that I used, you know, which were pulled right up to my knees, and they worked really well. Every morning we would try and wash a pair and put a clean pair on. And also we used talc as well on our feet, and we used this Compi Glide, like a silicone application that you put on that makes it supposedly slippy between the socks and your feet. So yeah, we we did look after our feet, and it was just this ritual every day of washing the socks and drying them on the outside of the rucksack. I think only once did we not wash them, you know, just because we couldn't, because there was no water. But it seemed to pay dividends, really, because, you know, going from, 3 degrees perhaps to 35 degrees, your feet are getting pretty hot, and especially when you're walking on a road as well that's probably over 40 degrees, all that heat's coming up into your shoes, into your feet, and you can easily lose your feet that way, as Steve says.
The biggest problem for your feet walking on tarmac is the time between 12 and 3 in the day, when, as Dean said, the tarmac temperature goes sky high. So what we employed a couple of times was to take a break, just like a 10 or 15 minute break in that kind of mid period. And that really reaped benefits, and we did that quite a few times. It was quite beneficial, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And occasionally we fell asleep as well. I remember you were setting the alarm to wake us up. And we certainly needed it, didn't we? Because we'd have probably still been there.
I had some relatively small blisters on the back of my heels from a previous event, to be honest, which was maybe 2 months before. So I'd already damaged the back of my heels. So during this, I had to kind of look after them a little bit more, because they were already damaged. So what I found was better than using the normal Compeeds that I would use, which were just no good because it was too hot. The skin got too hot, they rolled up, they came off, no protection. So instead, I started to just use a very simple antiseptic spray, tiny little bottle, put the antiseptic spray on the blister, and then put Compeed Glide or Friction Zone over the blister itself, and then covered the whole foot with foot talc. That worked so well. I never got any worse. The feet were in really, really good condition, and I think this kind of antiseptic stopped them going bad. I've used this in other kind of expeditions and stuff, is pinching very lightweight hotel slippers. And we used those quite effectively, didn't we, Dean?
We did, yeah. Yeah, they were very useful. I remember when you handed them out.
Yeah.
I thought, what are these for? But in fact, they were absolutely great. Yeah, they're fantastic.
And they weigh about 18 grams each, but they're just amazing for being able to take shoes off, shoes and socks, so it airs your feet. And it's that, you know, like nice thing to change into. They weigh nothing, really.
Yeah, and especially when you're washing your feet as well, it was good for that, wasn't it?
Yeah. It's just one of those things, it's not obvious, but it's particularly useful when you're on a long trip, I'd say.
But did they multi-purpose for anything? Could you use them for anything else apart from your feet?
I did. I lost the ends of my... They did multi-purpose. I lost the ends of my trekking poles, you know, like the ends that protect the trekking pole, because obviously it's really sharp. And they slotted into the back of the harness, so I used them to just protect the ends of the trekking pole, making sure that it didn't go through my harness. So, yeah, that was a multi-purpose.
Well, I'm pleased, you know, because it would have been a good tip, but if it didn't multi-purpose, then I would have been a bit disappointed.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell us about the spot then.
Okay, right. So I think everyone knows about the Spot GPS trackers. What we did was utilize them as a safety device because, well, you know, because we were on our own, we really needed to have some, you know, method of rescue if one of us had a problem with both of us, whatever. They had an added benefit that we could see each other as long as we had phone signal. We could see each other on the smartphones. And then thirdly, we were able to get a multi-tracking on our website, which meant that interested people could watch us both, which was something that was put on by Dave Wheeler.
Yeah, I mean, I used it to find out how close you were to my house to sort of realise I needed to get my skates on and stuff. But it was good to be able to track you, and I think it made a big difference to the trip in terms of kind of the people who were watching out for you and who were interested and wanted to follow you. I think that kind of stuff's really good.
Yeah, one other thing we had as well, on the spots, there's a button that you can customise a message, and we in fact customised that message to send to ourselves. So if we landed apart, we could just press the custom button and it would send a message. So if I landed somewhere, I would press the button, then the message went to Steve, he got the message, and he could then find out exactly where I landed. So that was really useful as well.
Another top tip for the spot is around the batteries, because they take AAA lithiums, which are really not easy to find. Well, certainly mine went down about halfway through the trip, and despite lots and lots of trying everywhere, we just couldn't buy these lithium AAAs all the way to the Med.
Strange, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, yeah, it was. It kind of became a little bit of a quest. And it was so funny walking into, you know, shops in one was in a city, and literally walked into this electrical shop and had this dead lithium AAA in my hand, and just kind of offered it to this guy, and he looked at it like it had, you know, like it was like kryptonite or something. He was like, ooh, we've heard of these. But he didn't have any.
So, I mean, would it work, would your spot work with other batteries, or was that, well, no, I know it must have done, because yes, you were still...
Yes, it does. It works with, you know, the high power alkalines, but it eats them literally within less than 2 days. It's gone through a set, which means that we were constantly on a mission to try and buy, and of course we were so concerned about weight, but we had to, well, I had to carry extra batteries for the eventuality of losing the spot. One of the other pieces of equipment that we took, which was incredibly useful and freed us up properly, was the Goal Zero solar charger. This was an essential piece of kit for us to maintain both communications and kind of sharing this trip with everybody who was watching. This piece of kit is so much better than any of the previous solar chargers that certainly I've tried on expeditions. This model is the Nomad 7 Adventurer, and it can charge a battery pack of four AAs in about 4 to 5 hours in kind of, you know, reasonable sunshine. And then for the rest of the time, we just topped up the 2 smartphones that we had. And this was incredibly successful. Before we went, I realized that we needed some way of mounting this to the bag, which the kind of device itself has got lots of kind of straps that we're adapted to fit to the top of the Nervous bag that we took. And it was fantastic, because basically everywhere I was walking, then the sun was shining on it and it was charging. So we never ever got a problem with the power. It's fantastic.
Well, I have to say, when you showed it to me, I was amazed at how robust it was, because, I mean, you could literally chuck it at a wall and it seemed to be unbreakable nearly.
I think that's fair, because one of the things is with the bag being just below the back of your head is once you start going through, you know, bushes and trees and you start ducking your head, the first thing that was getting hit was the solar charger, which at first we were quite concerned about. Eventually it just became, well, it was so robust when we took it. It's absolutely fine, very durable piece of kit. There was something else, which is about the use of routable GPS mapping, because that was definitely something that was a big benefit to me during X-Alps. Both of us had Garmin GPS devices that had 1 to 50,000 maps, like the Alpina Topos. But the big advantage of using this software on these devices is that you could route on paths, so point-to-point routing. And that becomes incredibly invaluable, because in addition to obviously where you're going, you know how much deviation away from the ideal route you are, how much height you're going to take, and importantly, a pretty good estimation of the time it'll take you from where you are to where you're trying to go to. And that really helped us a lot, because you know, kind of route planning was so important to try and get us into the right position to hopefully fly.
Yeah, that was something that I didn't even know about until about day two or three when Steve told me. I'd just been used to Auden Survey maps on the GPS, and of course they don't have any routing facility. So I found that out on the trip while Steve was using it. I didn't know. I just wondered why this software cost so much. I couldn't understand it. It actually works almost like the car sat nav. I thought, wow, that's fantastic. It's worth every penny.
Okay, talk me through your route choices then, because you said that was sort of a major discussion point in your preparation. Because, I mean, there are obviously very obvious routes across the Pyrenees.
We wanted to be on the Spanish side for obvious reasons, you know, mainly better weather, because the French side suffers from a lower cloud base. And we wanted to be as far south as possible to try and get the better weather, because, you know, we knew from experience that in the afternoon there's quite a bit of overdevelopment, and of course in the evenings as well there's some big storms. So we thought by staying south on the big mountains, but staying as far south as we can, then that would give us the best option.
So if you look at a large scale map of the route, the GR11 seem to give us the perfect kind of arc that we were looking for. So we did a lot of research based on pretty well where the GR11 was running. And what we decided partway through the kind of process of working out the route was that if we got detailed information on the GR11, it would give us the type of terrain that we were going to be faced with. As it turns out, we did stay on GR11, GT, GR10
yeah.
for some of the route, but definitely not all of it. But it was useful to base it on something.
Well, I mean, to be honest, the GR routes are so well marked, you know, it's really, well, I'm assuming that it was really helpful that you didn't have to kind of do a lot of navigation because you just follow the little markers.
Yeah, that's true, until the little markers disappear.
And that especially on the GR11.
That
really?
Yeah. That happened to us a couple of times, and it gave us some stressful moments, you know, putting us in the middle of nowhere. But you're right. That gave us the speed and efficiency to follow a route, and as you say, the majority of it is so easy to follow. It's just way marked with these little red and white markers, and in fact, when you kind of strayed off route and you felt like, oh no, we don't know where we're going, and then you'd see one and it'd be like seeing a friend again. It's like, oh, we're back on route.
Tell me about the ion light.
When we agreed that this was a good trip to do, obviously you want to take a lightweight glider. I mean, we were obviously going to choose an overwing because we're linked to the company in slightly different ways, but both of us were always going to fly an overwing, and we were deciding which wing to take about the same time that Nova had launched this Ion 2, which they were billing as a low-level B glider, EMB glider, that could be used to fly like a 200-kilometer FAI triangle in the Alps. And I already knew that they were going to produce an Ion 2 light, the same as they had the Ion light. So I thought, this is going to be a potential excellent wing for what we're trying to achieve. So I'd suggested to Dean as a good way of demonstrating what this glider could be possibly used for. And it would also give us the added bonus of having exactly the same kit, because this kind of trip wouldn't work if you were on significantly different performing wings.
Plus, it was very light, so it's weighed about 4.5 kilos, but it's not made out of the lightest material, you know, so it's still very robust. It also has a very small pack size, which is perfect for Vol Bivouac, and it's very easy to ground handle, which again is a very important thing for such an undertaking, because quite often you're flying in places taking off in places where you wouldn't normally take off, on rocks and on steep sides of mountains. So you need something that you're very confident with and that's going to ground handle well. And you did everything that Hanny said it would, and probably more really. We were just so impressed with the glider. Obviously I'm a little bit biased, but it performed absolutely superbly. I ended up taking the wrong size glider because I was in between sizes really, and I'd not figured that I'd lose about 5 kilos. So what I should have done was taken the extra small, because I was a little bit light on mine. But to be honest, it didn't make too much difference. I was just slightly slower than Steve on glide, but it climbed very well, so it was fine. But yeah, it's such a simple glider when you look at it, but it performs so well. And it allowed us to fly in, you know, on a couple of occasions, fairly strong conditions and absolutely stress-free. You know, we could just concentrate on the conditions and where we were flying.
The other thing was about shoes.
Yeah, we decided to, although we knew that we'd be going over some rough terrain, we were both quite happy in trail shoes. You know, we've used trail shoes for years, both of us, in the outdoors and nothing else really. And when I do my long walks, I always walk in a pair of trail shoes. The problem you can have with trail shoes is that, you know, if it's very wet, then obviously your feet get wet. But of course, that wasn't going to be a problem in the Pyrenees. But what it might have been was when we were flying, it may have been very cold. And of course, we're in open harnesses, so the air's getting through to your feet. So I took a pair of Gore-Tex socks as well. And I wore those on one day when we were getting up to just over 3,000 metres. But Steve didn't have any and he was fine. But I just took them as a precaution, really. But I would recommend, you know, if you're not used to wearing trail shoes and you're on rough terrain, I think you've got to, first of all, just start off slowly and work your way, you know, get used to using trail shoes in that environment, because just building up your ankle strength, really. But once you've done that, they're absolutely great, because, of course, you're going from temperatures, as we were, from like 2 or 3 degrees to 35 degrees. So boots in those conditions would have been very, very hot. So the trail shoes work really well. They do wear out quick, so you have to watch out for that as well.
Don't take platypus water containers. You know, yeah, I would always probably use a Camelback instead. That caused us quite a bit of bother, didn't it?
It did, yeah, because we took the really lightweight ones and they just weren't up to the job after a few days. They started leaking on the bite valves. I think I'd take probably Source or maybe Camelback.
You had these long kit discussions and you had decided what you weren't going to take and stuff. But you decided to take a luxury item, didn't you?
We did. We could take one luxury item each. And I decided, based again on some experience I'd had with X-Alps, which was using a very small battery-powered shaver. Because even though during this trip it was always possible to kind of wash yourself to maybe the standards that you used to, by having a quick shave, man, you just feel so good. So that was my 108 grams of luxury item.
Okay, and Dean, what was yours?
So I don't think I took anything, but I wish I had taken a razor blade.
I thought that your luxury item, Dean, was a second pair of underpants.
Yeah, maybe that was it, because I did go with this idea of just a one underpants strategy, we called it. And then I decided against it in the end. You know, I only wore one shirt, the same shirt, which sounds horrific, and it certainly was at times.
There's obviously a huge difference between doing it supported and unsupported. And, I mean, when I first saw your route map and everything, I was just like, oh, yeah, you know, we're all kind of, all of us who don't do this stuff are kind of familiar with this idea of doing it supported. And it was only really when I talked to you, when I saw you, that I realised kind of the enormity of the task that you were undertaking to do it unsupported. From your experience, you know, what would you say are the differences?
Well, from my own experience, I would say the major difference between the two is the kind of psychological side of it, and that's being the kind of lift that you get from knowing that your supporter will be at the end of some big hike or a long day or whatever you're doing, And the added bonus that they've probably got your favourite food, your favourite drink. You know, it's a massive difference. It really is. And just that knowing that somebody's there can keep you driving quite hard. Whereas we had absolutely opposite, which was, you know, a long 50K day, walking into the dark, really based on the hope that there may be something to eat or drink at the end. And the kind of elation or deflation at the end of that was either fantastic or harsh. And that's the massive difference, you know, psychologically, because a couple of times we did do that where we ended up with nothing. And it's a real kick.
I remember on one particular occasion as well, we flew down to a village quite late. Well, I think when we landed, it was actually dark. And we walked into a village hoping there'd be a bar there. It looked quite a reasonable size, but there was just nothing there. There was water, which was good, and we found shelter because we knew there were going to be some like big storms that night. But we knew the next day was a good flyable day, but we couldn't really do anything about it because we hadn't eaten for such a long time. So what we had to do then is find food. So we had to walk to the nearest town en route, and that was some 8 kilometres away or so, and then eat and get some food to go then back up into the mountains. So by that time, you'd missed a day's flying and there was nothing we could do about it.
The other thing is that if you have a supporter and they're in a vehicle, you can just take that much more kit, and you can change the kit when it's fulfilled its purpose. Or, you know, I mean, it would have made a huge difference to you if you could have had 2 or 3 pairs of shoes and 6 pairs of socks, presumably, and knowing that somebody else is washing them for you while you're walking.
Yeah, I mean, again, going back to my experience of the X-Alps, I had a van full of all different types of, like, footwear, different socks, and that opens up the possibility of changing socks in midday and changing shoes for different terrain. We had different backpacks for whether it was going to be wet weather or dry. But on this trip, there was no options. You know, everything that we left the West Coast with at Hendaye, that was going to go all the way pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, there was a point where we just sent some maps back, and we were going to send a few items of clothing back that we weren't using, but unfortunately, where we stopped, they only had one size of bag to put all the maps in, so we just managed to get the map sent off. But that made a big difference. You know, every 100 grams makes a difference. So the lighter you are, obviously, the easier you travel. And that was one of the problems with the food. You could only take so much food and water. Otherwise, it was a real burden trying to carry. It would have been like 20 kilos plus. You know, so we tried to keep it sort of around the 20 kilos, perhaps between sort of 16 and 20 kilos, because we found, you know, anything above the 20 kilos would be really difficult in those conditions.
I mean, getting food and water was a major undertaking for you on this trip. And I think it's probably worth a few tips to other people, because particularly in Spain, it can be an issue.
I don't think we quite figured it as bad as it was in certain places. I think in hindsight now, we probably would have carried the extra weight of 2 sandwiches, you know, baguette sandwiches for the next day instead of just carrying one, because it was so hit and miss where you couldn't get stuff. Water was less of an issue apart from height, you know, once you got up at height. So we found we could manage the water pretty well. It was more the management of the food, probably better to carry just that little bit more, because it has such a negative effect when you know that you've either run out or running out. And it's a psychological thing that, you know, you feel like you're running on empty, and your performance really is more affected than carrying an extra sandwich, I think.
I think one of the things about doing a trip like this is, it's doing a hike and fly, is that it's so difficult to plan how much water to take and how much food to take, because you never know, you know, whether you're going to be flying over a town or walking through it. So it's really difficult to plan. Whereas if you just walk in, it's a lot easier to plan. You can plan ahead the miles you've got to cover to the next town, and you know how much food to take to get to the next town and how much water to take. But of course, when you're doing this sort of thing, you just don't know.
Just basically the logistics here, you know, nothing, there's a big siesta time. Everything usually closes between 1 and 5 or even 5:30. A lot of, because of the crisis, less and less people can afford to go and eat out. So a lot of the restaurants are now only open at the weekends. You know, they're only open Sunday lunchtime. Like, Sunday's still sacred. You won't find a shop open on a Sunday. So if you don't get your food on a Saturday, you know you'll go hungry on a Sunday. So just things like that. The way the commercial side of things is organised here is not as easy as, say, for example, in Britain, where things are open 24/7.
Or even the Alps. It's far easier to get food on a more regular basis than what we found.
Well, actually, if you've probably stuck to the pilgrims' route, you know, because it's so well used, you probably wouldn't have had as many problems there either.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, we spent one period of, I think, 4 or 5 days where we didn't even come across a shop. We came across the odd bar, and so what we had to do is eat at the bar and then get them to make us a sandwich, you know, so we could carry on. But it was difficult. And of course, getting water is difficult in the Pyrenees, especially that time of year, because it's limestone. It's the end of the summer, so the streams are quite low.
And one of the driest years in years. We had this heat wave, but it was also, it didn't basically rain for like 4 months. So everything, the reservoirs were all getting low. A lot of the springs had dried up. In a sense, it wasn't a normal year for that.
Yeah.
So you were a bit unlucky.
I mean, one of the pluses is that most villages, as you know, have a fountain. So we knew that if we could get to a village fairly sort of high up in the Pyrenees, or well, not too high, but a reasonable height, we knew that we could probably get water because, you know, every village has got a fountain. But like you say, some of the fountains have dried up.
Right, I've got one final question, and that was about psychological boosts.
Yeah, I mean, they're really significant, and my experience with the Exalt was such that a lot of the time that was missing, as in knowing that somebody's going to be somewhere with either food, you know, different clothing, different shoes, that keeps you fired up. I mean, as we got closer and closer to the goal and realized that we could do this, and you know, you feel so psychologically different to, say, the middle of the trip, where we have this massive negative psychological effect of the weather forecast telling us that, you know, we weren't going to fly for 4 or 5 days. And I mean, simple things like seeing you at the side of the road with some water, you know, it gave us a real lift. And
yeah,
if that happens, you know, on a regular basis every day, you know, the supported side of things, it's unbelievable how it lifts you back up again. It's almost recharging you. Whereas we were finding ourselves getting pretty ground down by the fact that there wasn't a lot of hope of flying. Add to that the fact that there wasn't a lot of hope of finding food. And it really, I mean, we didn't. We're not at any single point did we get down or even touchy with each other. You know, I think we managed that really well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just like you say, it's the little things, isn't it? I remember coming out of the bar, I'm not sure where it was, but we'd been walking for most of the morning, found this superb bar, and we told the barman, spoke really good English, and we told him what we were doing, and we paid the bill and then just left the bar. And he came running after us with this, like, bag of nuts, you know, because he knew that we didn't have a lot of food. And just little things like that, just thought, well, that's so nice, you know, for him to do that. You know, yeah, it's surprising what gave you a little bit of a lift.
What would I give advice for somebody tackling a similar Volbiv trip? Well, without any doubt, it would be travel as light as you can absolutely possibly get away with and still obviously be safe. But as Dean said earlier, after days and days of hiking on the ground, you really do feel every single kilo that's in that pack. And just paring away 100 grams here, 100 grams there on this various bits of kit makes such a massive difference when it's all added up. It really does.
Yeah, and also getting back to the feet thing as well, just look after your feet. You can't look after them enough, really.
Thanks to Steve and Dean for their time and thoughts in putting this invaluable info together.